bed on the snow-covered step and lay there. She thought, I'll rest for a bit. Then I'll get up and make Sophie lunch. But what is there to eat? The next thing she knew, she was floating. No, maybe flying. She couldn't open her eyes. She was so tired and her head hurt. But she could feel herself moving, being rocked. Antoine, is that you? Are you holding me?
Open the door, someone said. And there was a crack of wood on wood, and then, I'm going to take off her coat. Go get Madame de Champlain, Sophie.
Vianne felt herself being laid on something soft. A bed. She wet her chapped, dry lips and tried to open her eyes. It took considerable effort and two tries. When she finally managed it, her vision was blurry. Captain Beck was sitting beside her on her bed, in her bedroom. He was holding her hand and leaning forward, his face close to hers.
Madame?
She felt his warm breath on her face.
Vianne!
Rachel said, coming into the room at a run. Captain Beck got to his feet instantly.
She fainted in the snow, madame, and cracked her head on the step. I carried her up here.
I'm grateful, Rachel said, nodding. I'll take care of her now, Herr Captain.
Beck stood there.
She doesn't eat, he said stiffly. All the food goes to Sophie. I have fought this.
That's motherhood in war, Herr Captain. Now, if you'll excuse me.
She stepped past him and sat down on the bed beside Vianne. He stood there another moment, looking flustered, and then he left the room.
So you are giving her everything, Rachel said softly, stroking Vianne's damp hair.
What else can I do? Vianne said.
Not die, Rachel said. Sophie needs you.
Vianne sighed heavily and closed her eyes. She fell into a deep sleep in which she dreamed she was lying on a softness that was acres and acres of black field, sprawled out from her on all sides. She could hear people calling out to her from the darkness, hear them walking toward her, but she had no desire to move. She just slept and slept and slept. When she woke, it was to find herself on her own divan in her living room, with a fire roaring in the grate not far away. She sat up slowly, feeling weak and unsteady.
Sophie?
The guest room door opened, and Captain Beck appeared. He was dressed in flannel pajamas and a woolen cardigan and his jack boots. He said,
Bonsoir, madame, and smiled. It is good to have you back.
She was wearing her flannel pants and two sweaters and socks and a knit hat. Who had dressed her?
How long did I sleep?
Just a day.
He walked past her and went into the kitchen. Moments later, he returned with a cup of steaming café au lait and a wedge of blue cheese and piece of ham and a chunk of bread. Saying nothing, he set the food down on the table beside her. She looked at it, her stomach grumbling painfully. Then she looked up at the captain.
You hit your head and could have died.
Vianne touched her forehead, felt the bump that was tender.
What happens to Sophie if you die? He asked. Have you considered this?
You were gone so long. There wasn't enough food for both of us.
Eat,
he said, gazing down at her. She didn't want to look away. Her relief at his return shamed her. When she finally did, when she dragged her gaze sideways, she saw the food. She reached out and took the plate in her hands, bringing it toward her. The salty, smoky scent of the ham, combined with the slightly stinky aroma of the cheese, intoxicated her, overwhelmed her better intentions, seduced her so thoroughly that there was no choice to be made. In early March of 1942, spring still felt far away. Last night, the Allies had bombed the hell out of the Renault factory in Boulogne-Billancourt, killing hundreds in the suburb on the outskirts of Paris. It had made the Parisians, Isabel included, jumpy and irritable. The Americans had entered the war with a vengeance. Air raids were a fact of life now. On this cold and rainy evening, Isabel pedaled her bicycle down a muddy, rutted country road in a heavy fog. Rain plastered her hair to her face and blurred her vision. In the mist, sounds were amplified. The cry of a pheasant disturbed by the sucking sound of her wheels in the mud. The near-constant drone of aeroplanes overhead. The lowing of cattle in a field she couldn't see. A woolen hood was her only protection. As if being drawn in charcoal on vellum by an uncertain hand, the demarcation line slowly came into view. She saw coils of barbed wire stretched out on either side of a black and white checkpoint gate. Beside it, a German sentry sat in a chair, his rifle rested across his lap. At Isabel's approach, he stood and pointed the gun at her.
"Halt!"
She slowed the bike. The wheels stuck in the mud, and she nearly flew from her seat. She dismounted, stepped down into the muck. 500 franc notes were sewn into the lining of her coat, as well as a set of false identity papers for an airman hiding in a safe house nearby. She smiled at the German, walked her bicycle toward him, thumping through muddy potholes.
"Documents," he said.
She handed him her forged Juliet papers. He glanced down at them, barely interested. She could tell that he was unhappy to be manning such a quiet border in the rain.
"Pass," he said, sounding bored.
She repocketed her papers and climbed back onto her bicycle, pedaling away as quickly as she could on the wet road. An hour and a half later, she reached the outskirts of the small town of Brantôme. Here, in the free zone, there were no German soldiers, although lately the French police had proven to be as dangerous as the Nazis, so she didn't let her guard down. For centuries, the town of Brantôme had been considered a sacred place that could both heal the body and enlighten the soul. After the Black Death and the Hundred Years' War ravaged the countryside, the Benedictine monks built an immense limestone abbey backed by soaring gray cliffs on one side and the wide Drôme River on the other. Across the street from the caves at the end of town was one of the newest safe houses, a secret room tucked into an abandoned mill built on a triangle of land between the caves and the river. The ancient wooden mill turned rhythmically, its buckets and wheel furred with moss. The windows were boarded up, and anti-German graffiti covered the stone walls. Isabel paused in the street, glancing both ways to make sure that no one was watching her. No one was. She locked her bicycle to a tree at the end of town, and then crossed the street and bent down to the cellar door, opening it quietly. All of the doors to the mill house were boarded up, nailed shut. This was the only way inside. She climbed down into the black, musty cellar and reached for the oil lamp she kept on a shelf there. Lighting it, she followed the secret passageway that had once allowed the Benedictine monks to escape from the so-called barbarians. Narrow, steeply pitched stairs led to the kitchen. Opening the door, she slipped into the dusty, cobwebby room and kept going upstairs to the secret 10x10 room built behind one of the old storerooms.
"She's here. Perk up, Perkins."
In the small room, lit only by a single candle, two men got to their feet, stood at attention. Both were dressed as French peasants in ill-fitting clothes.
"Captain Ed Perkins, miss,"
the bigger of the two men said.
"And this here lout is Ian Trufford or some such name. He's Welsh. I'm a Yank. We're both damned happy to see you. We've been going half mad in this small space."
"Only half mad?" she asked.
Water dripped from her hooded cloak and made a puddle around her feet. She wanted nothing more than to crawl into her sleeping bag and go to sleep, but she had business to conduct first.
"Perkins, you say?"
"Yes, miss."
"From?"
"Bend, Oregon, miss. My pa's a plumber and my ma makes the best apple pie in four counties."
"What's the weather like in Bend this time of year?"
What's this, middle of March? Cold, I guess. Not snowing anymore, maybe, but no sunshine yet.
She bent her neck from side to side, massaging the pain in her shoulders. All this pedaling and lying and sleeping on the floor took a toll. She interrogated the two men until she was certain they were who they said they were. Two downed airmen who'd been waiting weeks for their chance to get out of France. When she was finally convinced, she opened her rucksack and brought out supper, such as it was. The three of them sat on a ragged, mouse-eaten carpet on the floor, with the candle set in the middle. She brought out a baguette and a wedge of camembert and a bottle of wine, which they passed around. The Yank, Perkins, talked almost constantly, while the Welshman chewed in silence, saying no thank you to the offer of wine.
"You must have a husband somewhere who is worried about you," Perkins said as she closed her rucksack. She smiled. Already this had become a common question, especially from the men her age.
"And you must have a wife who is waiting for word," she said.
It was what she always said, a pointed reminder.
"Nah," Perkins said. "Not me. A lug like me don't have girls lining up. And now..."
She frowned.
Now what?
I know it's not exactly heroic to think about, but I could walk out of this boarded-up house in this town I can't fucking pronounce and get shot by some guy I got nothing against. I could die trying to bike across your hills.
Mountains.
I could get shot walking into Spain by the Spanish or the Nazis. Hell, I could probably freeze to death in your damned hills.
Mountains, she said again, her gaze steady on his. That's not going to happen.
Ian made a sighing sound.
There, you see, Perkins, this slip of a girl is going to save us.
The Welshman gave her a tired smile.
I'm glad you're here, miss. This lad's been sending me round the bend with his chatter.
You might as well let him talk, Ian. By this time tomorrow, it'll take all you have inside to keep breathing.
The hills?
Perkins asked, his eyes wide.
Oui. She said, smiling. The hills.
Americans. They didn't listen. In late May, spring brought life and color and warmth back to the Loire Valley. Vianne found peace in her garden. Today, as she pulled weeds and planted vegetables, a caravan of lorries and soldiers and Mercedes-Benzes rolled past Le Jardin. In the 5 months since the Americans had joined the war, the Nazis had lost all pretense of politeness. They were always busy now, marching and rallying and gathering at the munitions dump. The Gestapo and the SS were everywhere, looking for saboteurs and resistors. It took nothing to be called a terrorist, just a whispered accusation. The roar of aeroplanes overhead was nearly constant, as were bombings. How often this spring had someone sidled up to Vianne while she was in a queue for food or walking through town or waiting at the post and asked her about the latest BBC broadcast?
I have no radio. They are not allowed,
was always her response, and it was true. Still, every time she was asked such a question, she felt a shiver of fear. They had learned a new word, les collabos, the collaborators. French men and women who did the Nazis' dirty work, who spied on friends and neighbors and reported back to the enemy, relaying every infraction, real or imagined. On their word, people had begun to be arrested for little things, and many who were taken to the commandant's office were never seen again.
Madame Mauriac!
Sarah ran through the broken gate and into the yard. She looked frail and too thin, her skin so pale the blood vessels showed through.
You need to help my maman.
Vianne sat back on her heels and pushed the straw hat back on her head.
What's wrong? Did she hear from Mark?
I don't know what's wrong, madame. Maman won't talk. When I told her Ari was hungry and needed changing, she shrugged and said, What does it matter? She's in the backyard just staring at her sewing.
Vianne got to her feet and peeled off her gardening gloves, tucking them into the pocket of her denim overalls.
I'll check on her. Get Sophie and we'll all walk over.
While Sarah was in the house, Vian washed her hands and face at the outdoor pump and put away her hat. In its place, she tied a bandana around her head. As soon as the girls were with her, Vian put her gardening tools in the shed, and the three of them headed next door. When Vian opened the door, she found 3-year-old Ari asleep on the rug. She scooped him into her arms, kissed his cheek, and turned to the girls.
"Why don't you go play in Sarah's room?"
She lifted the blackout shade, saw Rachel sitting alone in the backyard.
"Is my maman okay?"
Sarah asked. Vian nodded distractedly.
"Run along now."
As soon as the girls were in the next room, she took Ari into Rachel's room and put him in his crib. She didn't bother covering him, not on a day this warm. Outside, Rachel was in her favorite wooden chair, seated beneath the chestnut tree. At her feet was her sewing basket. She wore a brown khaki twill jumpsuit and a paisley turban. She was smoking a small brown hand-rolled cigarette. There was a bottle of brandy beside her, and an empty cafe glass.
"Rach?"
"Sarah went for reinforcements, I see."
Vian moved to stand beside Rachel. She laid a hand on her friend's shoulder. She could feel Rachel trembling.
"Is it Mark?"
Rachel shook her head.
"Thank God."
Rachel reached sideways for the brandy bottle, pouring herself a glass. She drank deeply, emptied the glass, then set it down.
"They have passed a new statute," she said at last.
Slowly, she unfurled her left hand to reveal wrinkled bits of yellow cloth that had been cut into the shape of a star. Written on each one was the word Juif in black.
"We are to wear these," Rachel said. "We have to stitch them onto our clothes, the 3 pieces of outerwear we are allowed, and wear them at all times in public. I had to buy them with my ration cards. Maybe I shouldn't have registered. If we don't wear them, we are subject to severe sanctions, whatever that means."
Vian sat down in the chair beside her.
"But you've seen the posters in town, how they show us Jews as vermin to be swept away and money grubbers who want to own everything. I can handle it, but what about Sarah? She'll feel so ashamed. It's hard enough to be 11 without this, Vian."
"Don't do it."
"It is immediate arrest if you're caught not wearing it. And they know about me. I've registered. And there's Beck. He knows I'm Jewish."
In the silence that followed, Vian knew they were both thinking of the arrests that were taking place around Karivo, of the people who were disappearing.
"You could go to the free zone," Vian said softly. "It's only 4 miles away."
"A Jew can't get an Ausweis. And if I got caught?"
Vian nodded. It was true. Running was perilous, especially with children. If Rachel were caught crossing the frontier without an Ausweis, she would be arrested or executed.
"I'm afraid," Rachel said.
Vian reached over and held her friend's hand. They stared at each other. Vian tried to come up with something to say, a bit of hope to offer, but there was nothing.
"It's going to get worse."
Vian was thinking the same thing.
"Maman?"
Sarah came into the backyard, holding Sophie's hand. The girls looked frightened and confused. They knew how wrong things were these days, and both had learned a new kind of fear. It broke Vian's heart to see how changed these girls had already been by the war. Only 3 years ago, they'd been ordinary children who laughed and played and defied their mothers for fun. Now they moved forward cautiously, as if bombs could be buried beneath their feet. Both were thin, their puberty held at bay by poor nutrition. Sarah's dark hair was still long, but she'd begun to yank it out in her sleep, so there were balding patches here and there, and Sophie never went anywhere without Bebe. The poor pink stuffed animal was beginning to spew stuffing around the house.
"Here," Rachel said. "Come here."
The girls shuffled forward, holding hands so tightly they appeared fused together. And in a way they were, as were Rachel and Vian. joined by a friendship so strong it was maybe all they had left to believe in. Sarah sat in the chair by Rachel, and Sophie finally let her friend go. She came over to stand by Vianne. Rachel looked at Vianne. In that single glance, sorrow flowed between them. How could they have to say things like this to their children?
"These yellow stars," Rachel said, opening her fist, revealing the ugly little flower of ragged fabric with its black marking. "We have to wear them on our clothes at all times now."
Sarah frowned.
"But why?"
"We choose," Rachel said. "And we're proud of that. You have to remember how proud we are of it, even if people..."
"Nazis," Vianne said, more sharply than intended.
"Nazis," Rachel added, "want to make us feel bad about it."
"Will people make fun of me?"
Sarah asked, her eyes widening.
"I will wear one too," Sophie said.
Sarah looked pathetically hopeful at that. Rachel reached out for her daughter's hand and held it.
"No, baby, this is one thing you and your best friend can't do together."
Vianne saw Sarah's fear and embarrassment and confusion. She was trying her best to be a good girl, to smile, and be strong even as tears glazed her eyes.
"We,"
she said at last. It was the saddest sound Vianne had heard in nearly 3 years of sorrow. Chapter 21. When summer came to the Loire Valley, it was as hot as the winter had been cold. Vianne longed to open her bedroom window to let air in, but not a breeze stirred on this hot late June night. She pushed the damp hair from her face and slumped in her chair by the bed. Sophie made a whimpering sound. In it, Vianne heard a muddled, drawn-out,
"Maman,"
and she dipped her rag into the bowl of water she'd placed on the only remaining nightstand. The water was as warm as everything else in this upstairs room. She twisted the rag over the bowl, watched the excess water fall back into the bowl. Then she placed the wet rag on her daughter's forehead. Sophie muttered something incomprehensible and started to thrash. Vianne held her down, whispering love words in her ear, feeling heat against her lips. "Sophie," she said, the name a prayer with no beginning, no end.
"I'm here."
She said it over and over until Sophie calmed again. The fever was getting worse. For days now, Sophie had been ailing, feeling achy and out of sorts. At first, Vianne thought it was an excuse to avoid the responsibilities they shared. Gardening, laundry, canning, sewing. Vianne was constantly trying to do more, get more done. Even now, in the middle of the summer, she worried about the coming winter. This morning had shown Vianne the truth, however, and made her feel like a terrible mother for not seeing it from the start. Sophie was sick, very sick. She had been plagued by fever all day, and her temperature was rising. She hadn't been able to keep anything down, not even the water her body needed so desperately.
"How about some lemonade?" she said.
No answer. Vianne leaned over and kissed Sophie's hot cheek. Dropping the rag back into the bowl full of water, she went downstairs. On the dining room table, a box waited to be filled, her most recent care package to Antoine. She'd started it yesterday and would have finished and mailed it off if not for Sophie's turn for the worse. She was almost at the kitchen when she heard her daughter's scream. Vianne ran back up the stairs.
"Maman!"
Sophie croaked, coughing. It was a terrible rattling sound. She thrashed in the bed, yanking at the blankets, trying to shove them away. Vianne tried to calm her daughter, but Sophie was a wildcat, twisting and screaming and coughing. If only she had some of Dr. Collis Brown's chlorodyne. It worked magic on a cough, but of course there was none left.
"It's all right, Soph. Maman is here," Vianne said soothingly,
but her words had no effect. Beck appeared beside her. She knew she should be angry that he was here, here in her bedroom, but she was too tired and scared to lie to herself.
I don't know how to help her. There are no aspirin or antibiotics to be had at any price in town.
Not even for pearls?
She looked at him in surprise.
You know I sold my mamma's pearls?
I live with you, he paused. I make it my business to know what you are doing.
She didn't know what to say to that. He looked down at Sophie.
She coughed all night. I could hear it.
Sophie had gone still, frighteningly so.
She'll get better.
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a small bottle of antibiotics.
Here.
She looked up at him. Was she overstating it to think that he was saving her daughter's life? Or did he want her to think that? She could rationalize what it meant to take food from him. After all, he needed to eat, and it was her job to cook for him. This was a favor, pure and simple, and there would be a price for it.
Take it, he said gently.
She took the bottle from him. For a second, they were both holding it. She felt his fingers against hers. Their gazes locked, and something passed between them. A question was asked and answered.
Thank you, she said.
You are most welcome. Sir, the Nightingale is here.
The British consul nodded.
Send her in.
Isabel entered the dark, mahogany-lined office at the end of the elaborate hallway. Before she even reached the desk, the man behind it stood.
Good to see you again.
She sank into the uncomfortable leather chair and took the glass of brandy he offered. This latest crossing of the Pyrenees had been difficult, even in the perfect July weather. One of the American airmen had had difficulty following a girl's orders and had gone off on his own. They'd gotten word that he'd been arrested by the Spaniards.
Yanks,
she said, shaking her head. There was no more that needed to be said. She and her contact, Ian, codename Tuesday, had worked together from the beginning of the Nightingale escape route. With help from Paul's network, they had set up a complex series of safe houses across France and a group of partisans ready to give their lives to help the downed airmen get home. French men and women scanned the skies at night, watching for aeroplanes in trouble and parachutes floating downward. They combed the streets, peering into shadows, looking through barns, seeking Allied soldiers in hiding. Once back in England, the pilots couldn't fly missions again, not with their knowledge of the network. Instead, they prepared their colleagues for the worst, taught them evasion techniques, told them how to find help, and supplied them with franc notes and compasses and photographs ready-made for false papers. Isabel sipped the brandy. Experience had taught her to be cautious with alcohol after the crossing. She was usually more dehydrated than she realized, especially in the heat of summer. Ian pushed an envelope toward her. She took it, counted the franc notes inside, and slid the money into a pocket in her coat.
That's 87 airmen you've brought us in the past 8 months, Isabel, he said, taking his seat.
Only in this room, one-on-one, did he use her real name. In all official correspondence with MI9, she was the Nightingale. To the other employees of the consulate and in Britain, she was Juliet Gervais.
I think you should slow down.
Slow down?
The Germans are looking for the Nightingale, Isabel.
That's old news, Ian.
They're trying to infiltrate your escape route. Nazis are out there pretending to be downed airmen. If you pick up one of them...
We're careful, Ian. You know that. I interrogate every man myself, and the network in Paris is tireless.
They're looking for the Nightingale. If they find you...
They won't.
She got to her feet. He stood too and faced her.
Be careful, Isabel.
Always.
He came around the desk and took her by the arm and led her out of the building. She took a little time to enjoy the seaside beauty of San Sebastian, to walk along the path above the crashing white surf below, and enjoy buildings that didn't bear swastikas, but such moments of brushing up to ordinary life were a luxury she couldn't indulge for long. She sent Paul a message via courier that read, "Dear Uncle, I hope this note finds you well. I am at our favorite place by the sea. Our friends have arrived safely. Tomorrow I shall visit Grand-Mère in Paris at 3 o'clock. Love always, Juliette." She returned to Paris via a circuitous route. She stopped at each of the safe houses, in Carrevaux and Brantôme, and Pau and Poitiers, and paid her helpers. The feeding and clothing of airmen in hiding was no small undertaking, and since every man, woman, and child, mostly women, who maintained the escape route, did so at the risk of their lives, the network strived to make it not ruinous financially, too. She never walked through the streets of Carrevaux, hidden beneath a cloak and hood, without thinking about her sister. Lately, she had begun to miss Vianne and Sophie. Memories of their nights playing belote or checkers by the fire, Vianne teaching Isabel to knit or trying to, and Sophie's laughter had taken on a warm patina. She imagined sometimes that Vianne had offered Isabel a possibility she hadn't seen at the time, a home. But it was too late for that now. Isabel couldn't risk putting Vianne in danger by showing up at Le Jardin. Surely Beck would ask what she'd been doing in Paris for so long. Maybe he would wonder enough to check. In Paris, she exited the train amid a crowd of drab-eyed, dark-clothed people who looked like they belonged in an Edvard Munch painting. As she passed the glittering gold dome of the Invalides, a light fog moved through the streets, plucking color from the trees. Most of the cafes were closed, their chairs and tables stacked beneath tattered awnings. Across the street was the apartment she'd called home for the past month, a dark, squalid, lonely little attic tucked above an abandoned charcuterie. The walls still smelled vaguely of pork and spices. She heard someone yell, "Halt!" Whistles shrieked. People screamed. Several Wehrmacht soldiers, accompanied by French policemen, encircled a small group of people who immediately dropped to their knees and raised their arms. She saw yellow stars on their chests. Isabel slowed. Anouk appeared beside her, linking her arm through Isabel's. "Bonjour," she said in a voice so animated it alerted Isabel to the fact that they were being watched, or at least Anouk worried that they were. "You are like a character in one of those American comics, the way you appear and disappear. The Shadow, perhaps." Anouk smiled. "And how was your latest holiday in the mountains?"
"Unremarkable."
Anouk leaned close.
"We hear word of something being planned. The Germans are recruiting women for clerical work on Sunday night. Double pay. All very secretive."
Isabel slipped the envelope full of franc notes from her pocket and handed it to Anouk, who dropped it into her open handbag.
"Night work? And clerical?"
"Paul has gotten you a position," Anouk said. "You start at 9. When you are finished, go to your father's apartment. He will be waiting for you."
"Oui."
"It might be dangerous."
Isabel shrugged.
"What isn't?"
That night, Isabel walked across town to the Prefecture of Police. There was a hum in the pavement beneath her feet, the sound of vehicles moving somewhere close by. A lot of them.
"You there!"
Isabel stopped, smiled. A German walked up to her, his rifle at the ready. His gaze dropped to her chest, looking for a yellow star.
"I am to work tonight,"
she said, indicating the Prefecture of Police building in front of her. Although the windows were blacked out, the place was busy. There were German Wehrmacht officers and French gendarmes milling about, going in and out of the building, which was an oddity at this late hour. In the courtyard was a long row of buses parked end to end. The drivers stood together in a huddle, smoking and talking. The policeman cocked his head.
"Go."
Isabel clutched the collar of her drab brown coat. Although it was warm out, she didn't want to draw attention to herself tonight. One of the best ways to disappear in plain sight was to dress like a wren. Brown, brown, and more brown. She had covered her blonde hair with a black scarf, tied in a turban style, with a big knot in front,
and had used no cosmetics, not even lipstick. She kept her head down as she walked through a throng of men in French police uniforms. Just inside the building, she stopped. It was a huge space with staircases on either side and office doors spaced every few feet. But tonight it looked like a sweatshop, with hundreds of women seated at desks pressed close together. Telephones rang nonstop, and French police officers moved in a rush.
"You are here to help with the sorting?"
asked a bored French gendarme at the desk nearest the door.
"Oui. I'll find you a place to work. Come with me."
He led her around the perimeter of the room. Desks were spaced so closely together that Isabel had to turn sideways to make her way down the narrow aisle to the empty desk he'd indicated. When she sat down and scooted close, she was elbow to elbow with the women on either side of her. The surface of her desk was covered with card boxes. She opened the first box and saw the stack of cards within. She pulled out the first one and stared at it. Sternholtz, Isaac, 12 Avenue Rast, 4th Arrondissement, Sabotier, clogmaker. It went on to list his wife and children.
"You are to separate the foreign-born Jews," said the gendarme, whom she hadn't noticed had followed her.
"Pardon?" she said, taking out another card. This one was for Bear, Simone.
"That box there, the empty one, separate the Jews born in France from those born elsewhere. We are only interested in foreign-born Jews, men, women, and children."
"Why?"
"They're Jews. Who cares? Now get to work."
Isabel turned back around in her seat. She had hundreds of cards in front of her, and there were at least 100 women in this room. The sheer scale of this operation was impossible to comprehend. What could it possibly mean?
"How long have you been here?"
she asked the woman beside her.
"Days," the woman said, opening another box. "My children weren't hungry last night for the first time in months."
"What are we doing?"
The woman shrugged.
"I've heard them saying something about Operation Spring Wind."
"What does it mean?"
"I don't want to know."
Isabel flipped through the cards in the box. One near the end stopped her. Lévy, Paul, 61 Rue Blondine, Apartment C, 7th Arrondissement, Professor of Literature. She got to her feet so fast she bumped into the woman beside her, who cursed at the interruption. The cards on her desk slid to the floor in a cascade. Isabel immediately knelt down and gathered them up, daring to stick Monsieur Lévy's card up her sleeve. The moment she stood, someone grabbed her by the arm and dragged her down the narrow aisle. She bumped into women all down the row. In the empty space by the wall, she was twisted around and shoved back so hard she slammed into the wall.
"What is the meaning of this?"
snarled the French policeman, his grip on her arm tight enough to leave a bruise. Could he feel the index card beneath her sleeve?
"I'm sorry, so sorry. I need to work, but I'm sick, you see. The flu."
She coughed as loudly as she could. Isabel walked past him and left the building. Outside, she kept coughing until she got to the corner. There, she started to run.
What could it mean?
Isabel peered past the blackout shade in the apartment, staring down at the avenue. Papa sat at the dining room table, nervously drumming his ink-stained fingers on the wood. It felt good to be here again, with him, after months away, but she was too agitated to relax and enjoy the homey feel of the place.
"You must be mistaken, Isabel," Papa said, on his second brandy since her return. "You said there had to be tens of thousands of guards. That would be all the Jewish people in Paris, surely."
"Question what it means, Papa, but not the facts," she answered. "The Germans are collecting the names and addresses of every foreign-born Jewish person in Paris, men, women, and children."
"But why? Paul Lévy is of Polish descent, it's true, but he has lived here for decades. He fought for France in the Great War. His brother died for France. The Vichy government has assured us that veterans are protected from the Nazis."
Vianne was asked for a list of names, Isabel said. She was asked to write down every Jewish, communist, and Freemason teacher at her school. Afterward, they were all fired.
They can hardly fire them twice.
He finished his drink and poured another.
And it is the French police gathering names. If it were the Germans, it would be different.
Isabel had no answer to that. They had been having this same conversation for at least 3 hours. Now it was edging past 2 in the morning, and neither of them could come up with a credible reason why the Vichy government and the French police were collecting the names and addresses of every foreign-born Jewish person living in Paris. She saw a flash of silver outside. Lifting the shade a little higher, she stared down at the dark street. A row of buses rolled down the avenue, their painted headlamps off, looking like a slow-moving centipede that stretched for blocks. She had seen buses outside of the Prefecture of Police, dozens of them parked in the courtyard. Papa! Before she could finish, she heard footsteps coming up the stairs outside of the apartment. A pamphlet of some kind slid into the apartment through the slit beneath the door. Papa left the table and bent to pick it up. He brought it to the table and set it down next to the candle. Isabel stood behind him. Papa looked up at her.
It's a warning. It says the police are going to round up all the foreign-born Jews and deport them to camps in Germany.
We are talking when we need to be acting, Isabel said. We need to hide our friends in the building.
It's so little,
Papa said. His hand was shaking. It made her wonder again, sharply, what he'd seen in the Great War, what he knew that she did not.
It's what we can do, Isabel said. We can make some of them safe, at least for tonight. We'll know more tomorrow.
Safe? And where would that be, Isabel? If the French police are doing this, we are lost.
Isabel had no answer for that. Saying no more, they left the apartment. Stealth was difficult in a building as old as this one, and her father, moving in front of her, had never been light on his feet. Brandy made him even more unsteady as he led her down the narrow, twisting staircase to the apartment directly below theirs. He stumbled twice, cursing his imbalance. He knocked on the door. He waited to the count of 10 and knocked again, harder this time. Very slowly, the door opened, just a crack at first, and then all the way.
Oh, Julien, it is you, said Ruth Friedman.
She was wearing a man's coat over a floor-length nightgown, with her bare feet sticking out beneath. Her hair was in rollers and covered with a scarf.
You've seen the pamphlet?
I got one. Is it true? She whispered.
I don't know, her father said. There are buses out front, and lorries have been rumbling past all night. Isabel was at the Prefecture of Police tonight, and they were collecting the names and addresses of all foreign-born Jewish people. We think you should bring the children to our place for now. We have a hiding place.
But my husband is a prisoner of war. The Vichy government promises us that we will be protected. I am not sure we can trust the Vichy government, madame, Isabel said to the woman. Please, just hide for now.
Ruth stood there a moment, her eyes widening. The yellow star on her overcoat was a stark reminder of the way the world had changed. Isabel saw when the woman decided. She turned on her heel and walked out of the room. Less than a minute later, she guided her 2 daughters toward the door.
What do we bring?
Nothing, Isabel said. She herded the Friedmans up the stairs. When they reached the safety of the apartment, her father led them to the secret room in the back bedroom and closed the door on them.
I'll get the Wisniaks, Isabel said. Don't put the armoire back in place yet.
They're on the 3rd floor, Isabella. You'll never...
Lock the front door behind me. Don't open it unless you hear my voice.
Isabel, no.
She was already gone, running down the stairs, barely touching the banister in her haste. When she was nearly to the 3rd floor landing, she heard voices below. They were coming up the stairs. She was too late.
She crouched where she was, hidden by the elevator. Two French policemen stepped onto the landing. The younger of the two knocked twice on the Vizniak's door, waited a second or two, and then kicked it open. Inside, a woman wailed. Isabel crept closer, listening.
"Are Madame Vizniak?" the policeman on the left said. "Your husband is Emile, and your children Anton and Helene?"
Isabel peered around the corner. Madame Vizniak was a beautiful woman, with skin the color of fresh cream and luxurious hair that never looked as messy as it did now. She was wearing a lacy silk negligee that must have cost a fortune when it was purchased. Her young son and daughter, whom she had pulled in close, were wide-eyed.
"Pack up your things. Just the necessaries. You are being relocated," said the older policeman as he flipped through a list of names.
"But my husband is in prison near Pithiviers. How will he find us?"
"After the war, you will come back."
"Oh,"
Madame Vizniak frowned, ran a hand through her tangled hair.
"Your children are French-born citizens," the policeman said. "You may leave them here. They are not on my list."
Isabel couldn't remain hidden. She got to her feet and descended the stairs to the landing.
"I'll take them for you, Lily," she said, trying to sound calm. "No!"
the children wailed in unison, clinging to their mother. The French policeman turned to her.
"What is your name?"
one of them asked Isabel. She froze. Which name should she give?
"Rossignol,"
she said at last, although without the corresponding papers it was a dangerous choice. Still, Gervaise might make them wonder why she was in this building at almost 3 in the morning, putting her nose in her neighbor's business. The policeman consulted his list and then waved her away.
"Go. You are no concern to me tonight."
Isabel looked past them to Lily Vizniak.
"I'll take the children, madame."
Lily seemed not to comprehend.
"You think I'll leave them behind?" "I think..."
"Enough,"
the older policeman yelled, thumping his rifle butt on the floor.
"You,"
he said to Isabel,
"get out. This doesn't concern you."
"Madame, please," Isabel pleaded. "I'll make sure they are safe."
"Safe?" Lily frowned.
"But we are safe with the French police. We've been assured. And a mother can't leave her children. Someday you'll understand."
She turned her attention to her children.
"Pack a few things."
The French policeman at Isabel's side touched her arm gently. When she turned, he said,
"Go."
She saw the warning in his eyes, but couldn't tell if he wanted to scare her or protect her.
"Now."
Isabel had no choice. If she stayed, if she demanded answers, sooner or later her name would be passed up to the prefecture of police, maybe even to the Germans. With what she and the network were doing with the escape route, and what her father was doing with false papers, she didn't dare draw attention. Not even for something as slight as demanding to know where a neighbor was being taken. Silently, keeping her gaze on the floor, she didn't trust herself to look at them. She eased past the policeman and headed for the stairs. Chapter 22. After she returned from the Vizniak's apartment, Isabel lit an oil lamp and went into the salon, where she found her father asleep at the dining room table, his head resting on the hard wood as if he'd passed out. Beside him was a half-empty brandy bottle that had been full not long ago. She took the bottle and put it on the sideboard, hoping that out of reach would equal out of mind in the morning. She almost reached out for him, almost stroked the gray hair that obscured his face, a small, oval-shaped bald spot revealed by repose. She wanted to be able to touch him that way, in comfort, in love, in companionship. Instead, she went into the kitchen, where she made a pot of bitter, dark, made from acorns coffee, and found a small loaf of the tasteless gray bread that was all the Parisians could get anymore. She broke off a piece. What would Madame Dufour say about that?
eating while walking, and chewed it slowly.
"That coffee smells like shit," her father said, bleary-eyed,
lifting his head as she came into the room. She handed him her cup.
"It tastes worse."
Isabel poured another cup of coffee for herself and sat down beside him. The lamplight accentuated the roadmap look of his face, deepening the pits and wrinkles, making the flesh beneath his eyes look wax-like and swollen. She waited for him to say something, but he just stared at her. Beneath his pointed gaze, she finished her coffee. She needed it to swallow the dry, terrible bread, and pushed the empty cup away. Isabel stayed there until he fell asleep again, and then she went into her own room. But there was no way she could sleep. She lay there for hours, wondering and worrying. Finally, she couldn't stand it anymore. She got out of bed and went into the salon.
"I'm going out to see," she announced.
"Don't," he said, still seated at the table.
"I won't do anything stupid."
She returned to her bedroom and changed into a summer-weight blue skirt and short-sleeved white blouse. She put a faded blue silk scarf around her messy hair, tied it beneath her chin, and left the apartment. On the third floor, she saw that the door to the Wisniak apartment was open. She peered inside. The room had been looted. Only the biggest pieces of furniture remained, and the drawers of the black Bombay chest were open. Clothes and inexpensive knick-knacks were scattered across the floor. Rectangular black marks on the wall revealed missing artwork. She closed the door behind her. In the lobby, she paused just long enough to compose herself, and then opened the door. Buses rolled down the street, one after another. Through the dirty bus windows, she saw dozens of children's faces, with their noses pressed to the glass, and their mothers seated beside them. The sidewalks were curiously empty. Isabel saw a French policeman standing at the corner, and she went to him.
"Where are they going?"
"Vélodrome d'hiver."
"The sporting stadium? Why?"
"You don't belong here. Go, or I'll put you on a bus and you'll end up with them."
"Maybe I'll do that. Maybe..."
The policeman leaned close, whispered,
"Go."
He grabbed her arm and dragged her to the side of the road.
"Our orders are to shoot anyone who tries to escape. You hear me?"
"You'd shoot them? Women and children?"
The young policeman looked miserable.
"Go."
Isabel knew she should stay. That was the smart thing to do. But she could walk to the Veldive almost as quickly as these buses could drive there. It was only a few blocks away. Maybe then she would know what was happening. For the first time in months, the barricades on the side streets of Paris were unmanned. She ducked around one and ran down the street, toward the river, past closed-up shops and empty cafes. Only a few blocks away, she came to a breathless stop across the street from the stadium. An endless stream of buses jammed with people drew up alongside the huge building and disgorged passengers. Then the doors wheezed shut and the buses drove off again. Others drove up to take their place. She saw a sea of yellow stars. There were thousands of men, women, and children looking confused and despairing, being herded into the stadium. Most were wearing layers of clothing, too much for the July heat. Police patrolled the perimeter like American cowboys herding cattle, blowing whistles, shouting orders, forcing the Jewish people forward, into the stadium or onto other buses. Families. She saw a policeman shove a woman with his baton so hard she stumbled to her knees. She staggered upright, reaching blindly to the little boy beside her, protecting him with her body as she limped toward the stadium entrance. She saw a young French policeman and fought through the crowd to get to him.
"What's happening?"
she asked.
"That's not your concern, mademoiselle. Go."
Isabel looked back at the large cycling stadium. All she saw were people, bodies crammed together,
families trying to hold on to each other in the melee. The police shouted at them, shoved them forward toward the stadium, yanked children and mothers to their feet when they fell. She could hear children crying. A pregnant woman was on her knees, rocking back and forth, clutching her distended belly.
"But there are too many of them in there,"
Isabel said.
"They'll be deported soon."
"Where?"
He shrugged.
"I know nothing about it."
"You must know something."
"Work camps," he mumbled. "In Germany, that's all I know."
"But they're women and children."
He shrugged again. Isabel couldn't comprehend it. How could the French gendarmes be doing this to Parisians? To women and children?
"Children can hardly work, monsieur. You must have thousands of children in there, and pregnant women. How?"
"Do I look like the mastermind of this? I just do what I'm told. They tell me to arrest the foreign-born Jews in Paris, so I do it. They want the crowd separated, single men to Drancy, families to the Veldive. Voila, it's done. Point rifles at them and be prepared to shoot. The government wants all of France's foreign Jews sent east to work camps, and we're starting here."
"All of France?" Isabel felt the air rush out of her lungs. Operation Spring Wind.
"You mean this isn't just happening in Paris?"
"No, this is just the start."
Vianne had stood in queues all day, in the oppressive summer heat, and for what? A half a pound of dry cheese and a loaf of terrible bread?
"Can we have some strawberry jam today, Maman? It hides the taste of the bread."
As they left the shop, Vianne kept Sophie close to her, tucked against her hip as if she were a much younger child.
"Maybe just a little. But we can't go overboard. Remember how terrible the winter was? Another will be coming."
Vianne saw a group of soldiers coming their way, rifles glinting in the sunshine. They marched past, and tanks followed them, grumbling over the cobblestone street.
"There is a lot going on out here today," Sophie said.
Vianne had been thinking the same thing. The road was full of French police. Gendarmes were coming into town in droves. It was a relief to step into Rachel's quiet, well-tended yard. She looked forward to her visits with Rachel so much. It was really the only time she felt like herself anymore. At Vianne's knock, Rachel peered out suspiciously, saw who was at the door, and smiled, opening the door wide, letting sunshine stream into the bare house.
"Vianne, Sophie, come in, come in!"
"Sophie!"
Sarah yelled. The two girls hugged each other as if they'd been apart for weeks instead of days. It had taken a toll on both of them to be separated while Sophie was sick. Sarah took Sophie by the hand and led her out into the front yard, where they sat beneath an apple tree. Rachel left the door open so that they could hear them. Vianne uncoiled the floral scarf from around her head and stuffed it into the pocket of her skirt.
"I brought you something."
"No, Vianne,
we have talked about this," Rachel said.
She was wearing a pair of overalls that she'd made from an old shower curtain. Her summer cardigan, once white and now grayed from too many washings and too much wear, hung from the chair back. From here, Vianne could see two points of the yellow star sewn onto the sweater. Vianne went to the counter in the kitchen and opened the silverware drawer. There was almost nothing left in it. In the 2 years of the occupation, they had all lost count of the times the Germans had gone door to door, requisitioning what they needed. How often had Germans broken into the homes at night, taking whatever they wanted? All of it ended up on trains headed east. Now, most of the drawers and closets and trunks in town were empty. All Rachel had left were a few forks and spoons and a single bread knife. Vianne took the knife over to the table. Withdrawing the bread and cheese from her basket, she carefully cut both in half and returned her portion to the basket. When she looked up again, Rachel had tears in her eyes.
"I want to tell you not to give us that. You need it."
"You need it too."
I should just rip the damn star off. Then at least I would be allowed to queue up for food when there was still some to be had.
There were constantly new restrictions.